You are listening to the Experience Points podcast for the week of January 3rd, 2024, and it's the game of the year.
Welcome back to the Experience Points podcast. I'm George Albor.
My name is Scott Chester.
And we're the co-creators of a serious but a humorous conversation about video games. That's this podcast you're listening to right now. And the year is over. We are back in 2024. It's our last chance to talk about 2023. We are talking about our games of the year. It is time.
It is time. Man, what a year it's been. But as always, we're going to be disciplined. We're just going to pick three each and talk about them, even though approximately 300 came out this year.
Yeah, we're not cowards. We're not doing top 50, top 10, not even top 5. Top 3. Decisions have been made, okay? It has been a truly wild year. And I think it is going to be a year that is, I've said this before, but I think it'll be remembered like in a decade. Like, oh man, 2023. That was a crazy year for video games in terms of not just the quantity, but the quality of so many good games. There were many games this year that I played where I was like, straight to the list with you as soon as they were done.
Boom, to the moon.
Yeah. So like, it's always been a complicated year. And I think every year I'm always like, man, it was hard to make my choice. I actually don't think it was too hard for me this year, but the closeness of the quality is extremely high.
Oh yeah.
Because there are some games that are, I would say, even like if I made this list 10, my 11th favorite game of the year is still a fucking great game. Yep. You know, like it's just that, it's that degree of quality this year. We like to start this off by trying to predict how many games we will have overlap.
Yes.
I think usually we're pretty spot on. Because you and I, you know, we've been doing this for a very long time. We know each other pretty well. Scott, how many games do you think will be on each of our lists?
This year is such a wild card, but I think we will overlap one time.
I agree. I think we'll also overlap one time.
Yeah.
Man, weird. Okay. Sweet. I do want to caveat a little bit my list because I think that there are games that came out this year that are better maybe than one or more of the games on my list, right? Like, but they stuck with me for whatever reason, right? Like, it's just part of that experience throughout this year that
you this lasts. Is a personal list, not a, you didn't try to remove yourself to make an academic best games of 2020.
Yeah, and every year, you know, I try to like have some degree of coverage, right? Of like, okay, what are the, you know, do I have like an indie game there? And you know, oftentimes it comes down to games that inspire me, that fill me with awe at what games can do, that not just excel in their craft, because there's a lot of games this year that were excellent in their craft, but that provide a glimpse of the games to come and the stories that I want to experience through play. And I think that's never been more true than this year's list, as I've left some games that I think are stellar off to the side. So I just want to caveat that, because inevitably people will look at a list and go, what's like, what, that shouldn't be on there. So with that out of the
Fortnite.
Way,
Fortnite.
Yeah. Do you want to start us off with your number three game of the year?
I can start us off with number three. I also will caveat my list by saying I feel like this is probably the most stereotypical list that I will that I've had in many a year.
Meaning like everyone loves these games?
Well, and also I specifically like this. Not only are the games everyone, I don't think they're necessarily surprised, but it's also like, oh yeah, anyone who knows anything about my tastes will probably be like, yes, this is a, oh, take a drink type of list.
I mean, you know what, before you tell me, because we don't know what each other's lists are, I'm gonna write down what I think all three of your games are.
Yes.
Because I think I'll know it.
Yeah. Okay. I think this is the
with
most
you being said,
this is like one of my most predictable years, I think.
Okay, sweet. I can't wait.
Number three on my list is Super Mario Brothers Wonder.
Nice. I was wrong already. I would have said Cocoon, but awesome.
Yeah, I mean, again, a year where any one of, even if I expanded out the list, any one of the top 10 games would have been in contention for a top three in most other years.
Yep.
But I mean, Super Mario Wonder, we talked about it recently because it came out kind of in the fall. Yeah. But I just, and I played a little bit more of it here at the end of the year just to kind of revisit it. And, you know, the kids have been around out of school, so we played a little bit more of it. But it's just such a, it's such a quietly assured game. It's not, you know, it is flashy, but it's not bombastic. And the changes it makes are actually subtle changes, but they are huge changes under the covers. And so it's kind of that thing that we were talking about when we discussed it on the show, where we, you know, partially because we probably weren't super into the marketing cycle of this game, and partially because I actually don't think they promoted it a huge amount, is they just like secretly turned this into a Strand game, and I had really no clue about that going in. And it makes a huge difference when you're playing it. Like it's like a massive difference, but it's subtle. Like you're still going from left to right and you're jumping on dudes and you're getting power-ups, but the Souls and Strand influence is meaningful when you're playing those levels. And there's just a long list of those types of changes that don't, it's not the 2D to 3D transition where it's like, oh, this is clearly different, you know, from the jump. It's like there's a million little differences from the Strand stuff to there's no timer on the levels to a million of other little things that it's just this like quietly kind of progressive Mario that they put out. And you know, not only that, it just feels great to play. So like it was easily up at the top of my list.
Yeah, it's a very good game. I was I have a friend who recently got a Switch for Christmas, and I had recommended picking up Super Mario Brothers Wonder as like one of the first games to play. There's something that I think is so cool about it, in that at the same time, Super Mario Brothers Wonder feels classic Mario, right? It is left to right, go.
Yep.
But it also features some elements that just feel so modern. Yes. And this is someone that has not played a lot of video games in many, many years. Like they, you know, does not own PlayStation 5 or an Xbox. This is they're sort of fresh back onto games. Yep. And I think Super Mario Brothers Wonders is one of the one of the best games to pick up from someone like that, like who has lapsed, maybe who's familiar with Mario, but has not been playing a lot of games, to get something that is new and exciting and fresh that you might recognize elements from this. Like, not to say he should go play Dark Souls 3, but the Strand game idea is not going away ever again, right? Like, that is here to stay.
Yes.
You will see that in other games, and it's cool to see it in action in Mario Brothers Wonders from you and I's perspective, because it isn't new, right? Like, this is a modern take using the Mario formula. But if you're totally fresh, like, if you're not like you and I that are sort of nerding about it, it's such a great entry point, because it is straddling those two worlds of new and exciting and fashionable, but also just good old classic Mario with the right level of challenge that is fun for the whole family.
That's a great point. You're being exposed to a bunch of relatively fresh gameplay concepts, but secretly.
Yes.
It's like, whoops, I got a secret crash course on the last 5 years of game design by accident, because this game that came out, 35 years ago, it has been updated to now encompass them.
It's also just fucking fun, dude. Like, it's just, it's such silly good times. Like, laughing out loud in a Mario game, like, that's just, it's not that common, you know, outside of weird multiplayer hijinks or something, you know? So
there was multiple times this year where I was playing games that I was just, Hana makes fun of me because she says when I'm playing games, it looks like I'm, you know, watching a presidential debate or something. Like, I just am stone faced.
Yeah. Brow furrowed.
Yeah. And I'm like, oh man, I love that game. I had a great time. She's like, oh really? Like, you look like you were reading War and Peace or something. And like, but it's like, there were multiple games this year where I was just, I know I was grinning when I was playing the game. And this was one of them for sure.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, very good choice. Very good choice.
Number three for you.
All right, number three for me. This is the spot that I think was the most contentious, but it had to go to this because I just kept coming back to it. That is Chance of Sinnar.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this is a game from a small French studio called Rundisk that is about translating languages. I talked about it a little bit on the podcast, but I think the reason why it stuck to me is the way that this particular puzzle unfolds. You know, it's not just that it is a vibe game. It is, right? It is a quiet, meditative, just you and trying to figure out these languages. It is the particular approach to solving a puzzle. So another great game, Cocoon, which came out in 2023, we talked a little bit about how you're holding something in your mind, but in a lot of puzzle games that you're trying to solve, even great ones, you're always taking an action, right? Like you're always moving, you're always testing, you're always trying something new. You're moving your physical person around, right? You're pushing on the walls of the world. There are many, many puzzles in Chance of Sinar that in which I just kind of set the game down and thought. I was trying to think about it, right? Yeah. And there's something about sort of the quiet puzzling out of a solution that feels exceedingly rare in games to me, even puzzle games, right? Yeah. Like it's much more akin to something like there's a board game that I love called Sherlock Detect. I forget what it's called. It's a Sherlock game where you're trying to solve murders, right?
Oh yeah, Consulting Detective.
Consulting Detective, yeah, Sherlock Consulting Detective. There's a series of these. Great, great little board game, and much of that board game is you thinking. You're looking at your notes and you're just trying to think it out, right? And there's something about the process of it. Like I recently rewatched the film Spotlight, which is just another one of my like weird, I just love a movie about people just doing fucking work, you know, like they're just in a room and they're thinking, right?
Yeah.
That experience I think was captured really well in Chance of Sinar, and it, the joy of solving a solution, of piecing it together feels very much earned. Yes, there are elements of the game that are giving things to you, but for the most part, it feels like it is the satisfying sense of accomplishment you get from learning an actual thing through quiet contemplation.
Yeah.
And that's just, it's such a rarity to me. And in a year of like a lot of big bombastic games as well, this one just hit that right vibe for me. And I really enjoyed just the whole experience.
I was thinking about this game and your description of it, where it's a game about thinking through a solution, and that's the action of the game, kind of the main compelling action. And it reminded me of, it's just like the best Star Trek episodes. Like you can see Jean-Luc Picard being dumped into the world of Chance of Sinar and having to figure it out by the end of the 42 minutes or whatever.
Yes.
Like, oh, yes, I put together the language. You know, it's like, it's just that as, but
Chance of Sinar at Tanagra. Yes. Yeah.
His arms wide.
His arms wide. Yeah.
But just that sort of cultural discovery doesn't get done in games that often.
Yes.
And it's so cool to see it pulled off like that in a way that everyone recognizes as really clever and really useful and workable.
Well, so many games, even puzzle games, are just fundamentally action-based, right? Like you need to take some kind of action. And yes, there are puzzles that you think about and, you know, things you have to move and walls you've got to change and all that kind of stuff. But again, like that quiet thinking about it is just extremely satisfying. I wish this game was much longer. I wish this game just actually taught me a real language. You know, like if Rosetta Stone was like, look, we need to upgrade our fucking service because people don't want to learn Esperanto anymore. Like use this system and I will be happy.
What if we see we see Rosetta Stone or whoever, We've acquired the studio, and they will be the ones gamifying language learning. Now, would you like to learn Swedish? Oh, sweet, finally.
Yeah, we did it with Rocksmith, you know, let's do it for languages.
Okay, cool. My second?
Your second, which I think will be my second. I think this is where the overlap will come.
I think so.
And if so, I will say so.
Yeah, but okay. Second on my list is Alan Wake 2.
Second on my list is also Alan Wake 2.
There we go. This is the overlap.
this is the overlap.
I think
isn't that a term in Alan Wake 2?
There's the so many. The dark place, the mind place.
Yes.
the overlap. All like everything. There's just, and I think that is the thing where this game, I've been thinking about it more and more as the year has wrapped up, and it just walks such a tightrope successfully of for me anyway, where like all of that stuff, the mind place, the dark place, the overlap, all of that stuff, it could just go so wrong at any given time. But they just stay on that tightrope and they make it to the other side. And especially if you're there wanting to also get to the other side, it's just such an accomplishment of striking that line between something super serious and artistic and something that knows how the absurdity of the medium can lend itself to storytelling and leans into it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you were talking about games in which you were just grinning ear to ear while you played. Like Alan Wake 2, constantly doing that. Even in moments that were unsettling. Because we talked a little bit about it during our debrief, our longer like full spoiler debrief. Mm-hmm. But Alan Wake 2 is also genuinely terrifying. I think it's one it's one of the more horrifying, scary games that I've played that I would rank so highly. Because I think you walk this careful line where if it's truly scary, I'm kind of put off and I don't want to play it. But this game is scary. It is violent. It is graphic.
Yep.
But it's also hilarious and funny and weird and compelling in all those different ways. I think it walks that line wonderfully as well.
I've heard some folks talk about the actual moment-to-moment gameplay of it. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if, with a little bit of distance now, did you have any additional thoughts around the actual pressing of the buttons and engaging with the systems of it? Because I have an opinion, but I want to hear yours first.
Yeah, when I think of Alan Wake's sequences, that feels like all of that is in service to the puzzle of it all, right? Like the gunfire isn't as robust as Saga's.
Yes.
She doesn't have as many gun options. It's largely like, do you have the battery? And most of the time, you're running out of juice on that flashlight. So, like, you got to keep running, right? And ignoring it. Saga stuff felt a little bit more compelling, and it felt fine. You equated it a little bit to Resident Evil. Like, it is a slow-paced thing.
Yeah.
I talked about reloading arrows, but reloading any weapon feels like a nightmarish endeavor. Like, it's horrifying. Or, you know, reloading and realizing you're out of ammo. I think the one complaint I would have about the minute-to-minute stuff is inventory management is kind of a weird little pain. Because I there's a lot of it. There's just a lot of items in Saga stuff. And I didn't unlock her whole inventory system. But
did you get any of the inventory upgrades? Or did I got like one or two lines? Or
yeah, I got like one or maybe two upgrades, but not the whole pack. Because some of the guns take up space, and the rifle is like fucking huge. You know, you're not supposed to be carrying a bazooka. You know, so, but yeah, I enjoyed it. I mean, it's not a run and gun shooter, right? Like, it really feels like you're just kind of preparing for the boss fights, which are just shit yourself. Where is this guy? Moment, you know. Yeah. And there's so much visually going on that I think the slow methodical pace of shooting pays off, because even when an enemy is approaching, they are physically distorting the environment and like visually distorting what you're seeing. You can't always be certain where you're aiming. Sometimes their weak spots on their back, so it just becomes this like complicated to read environment where you need to sort of take a breather, right? Like calm yourself down and aim, right? And I enjoy that. I enjoy the tension that builds into it.
Yes, I mean, agreed on all of those counts. I was thinking about it and was wondering, is this the most, is this the least outstanding mechanical game that has ever been so high on our list?
Oh, I think that's probably true. Yeah.
You know, like, we think about things like
it's not like God of War. Great.
Yeah, exactly. Or Vampire Survivors, or, you know, even, I don't know, even some of the more mainstream ones, like, you know, say what you will about the story, but like, you know, Metal Gear has exquisite controls, and like the Alan Wake stuff, I still don't know if I was doing the ducking and dodging right by the end of that game.
Yes, yeah.
You know, maybe I was, maybe I wasn't, I don't know. And I've heard other people say similar things, but it struck me as like that, it never struck me as a problem, and it was fine, even though it was a little mushy. It's not even as good, I don't think, as, you know, the as its contemporaries, like Resident Evil or Dead Space or whatever, but the combination of some of that aesthetic stuff with how they link it up to, you know, the minute-to-minute aiming and shooting and picking things up does make a big difference, because it is mushy and it is, oh man, is that just like a wavy apparition or is that an actual ghost coming at me? You know, it's there is some uncertainty there that covers over the fact that I think just from a button pressing perspective, this game is just fine.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good point. You know, this is going to sound like a weird comparison, because I think the story itself also is a little bit rough around the edges, right? Like there are weird elements that just, not that they feel wrong, but maybe aren't like fully thought out, right? Like it's like morsels to get you thinking, right?
Yeah.
And this is going to sound like a weird comparison, but your wife is in theater and this kind of feels like, again, this is, follow me here, but like a one man play, right? Where it's like, it is stretching what's possible given the limitations to its limit.
Yeah.
But a good one man play could be just as evocative as a beautifully rendered set that shifts and has lighting effects and fire and water, right? Like you can do a lot with something that is rough and ready, right?
Yes.
And even have that aesthetic weave its way into the story. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of what Alan Wake 2 accomplishes also, right? Yeah. Like the strange tidbits of the story are themselves pieces of mystery that are sort of glommed on, or aspects of the story that are shifting and changing based upon other characters, right? Like there are other artists in the world of Alan Wake 2 that aren't just Alan, whose work are affecting your experience, right?
Yeah.
Timothy Zane is the best example, but there's also like an artist staying at the hotel, and there's like references to, you know, poets coming to the town. So there's just like little tidbits that I think maybe don't work in the minute-to-minute experience perfectly, but when you experience the whole tapestry, just kind of fits well and matches the aesthetic, and I don't know, I was okay with it. Does that make sense? Yeah. Is that analogy too weird?
Well, it's not weird, because the significant chunks of this game are one-man plays, because you have...
Yes, it's like Alan in a room. Yeah. Two of him.
Or like Saga talking directly into the camera about herself. You know, like it's just...
Yeah.
There are significant chunks of this game where all of the work is being done by an actor staring at the camera just point blank,
which is
like the ultimate one man show perspective. So like, it's exactly, but then they layer more stuff onto it where it's like, you know, you have the CG character staring straight into the camera, and then it jump cuts really quick to the FMV version, or maybe it overlays the FMV version of Alan Wake talking to the CG version of Saga. But then the CG version of Saga pops into the other side of the frame. Mm-hmm. Like they're just doing a lot of that stuff where it's just fully character based, and it's throwing ideas out there, and it's putting the performances out there alongside the plot to kind of convey what's going on, even if you're not fully following, or if maybe you haven't even played the first game and you have to kind of catch up to where it is. But I totally understand that analogy. Yeah. And I think they draw a lot of inspiration from other non-video game art forms.
I think there's another good analogy. There are certain films that you can tell were made by someone who is an expert in that field, right? So stunt coordinators who are directly involved in producing John Wick, for example, right? The action works wonderfully in those films because people at the top of their game are crafting that as its focus, right?
Yep.
Or Maestro, the recent Carey Mulligan and what's his face film, right? Like this is an actor's movie made and directed by an actor to showcase acting, right? It is not a tour de force of cinematography or direction, because that's not the purpose of it. The purpose is to highlight acting. And I think in that way, Alan Wake 2 is a writer's story, right? This is a writer's video game. And a game writer's video game in particular, like not just a, you know, someone who wants to make a movie made a video game, which is I complain about for some narrative based single player games. This is someone who's really interested in games writing, and they did a really fucking good job. And even if the mechanics aren't perfect or don't fit perfectly, it's a showcase of what a creative mind at the top of the game can do when they're allowed the room to make something weird and personal.
Yeah, agreed. I also thought it was one of those games where, you know, sometimes I try to take myself out of the medium for a second and think to myself, what would someone, kind of like your friend, how you were talking about how they don't play many video games, they're just now getting a Switch. Like, what if someone who left games...
I would not recommend Alan Wake 2.
but would they even recognize it? Like, would it be an alien life form? Like, if they last checked in with video games with, like, Street Fighter 2 on the Genesis, and then they came back and was like, this isn't a video game. This, I mean, I understand you're holding a controller, but what the fuck is this? You know, like, it just is almost... it pushes things forward a little bit.
It does, it does. It's like saying, like, let's say you talk to your parent or grandparent who watches the Oscars every year, and they're like, oh, what's the video game Oscars look like? And then you put on the Game Awards and it's Sam Lake dancing musical, you know, like, and that's the creative director. Like, that, it doesn't make any sense. There's no one-to-one here.
It's just, there are some games that just push things forward a little bit, and this is one of them. And I really do wonder if, you know, we do think about these things every once in a while where it's like, oh, is this the moment where things get pushed forward and they stick, you know, the wave comes in, and of course the wave recedes, but has it pushed the tide further in? And so I think the Dark Souls stuff is a perfect example of that, where, like, yeah, sure, things ebb and flow, but the Strand stuff is here for good at this point.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, things that maybe haven't necessarily caught on, you know, we talk about things like, you know, the Nemesis system, or some of the things that we saw in strategy games like Into the Breach or whatever. Like, it feels like some of that stuff hasn't caught on. And so, like, I think about Alan Wake, where, especially from a storytelling perspective, is this where the integration of different media and the integration of full motion video, or the integration of kind of like the corkboard storytelling with the in-game engine storytelling at the same time, like, is this something that we start to see more of, because it's just such a showcase of what is possible? Like this game, it sounds hyperbolic, but like, this game did things that it used the different visual styles in such a way that I just hadn't really thought was possible to do that cleanly, and yet they did it. And so it's like, oh, there's this I forget what the concept is, but there's this phenomenon where if someone they look at it in terms of athletic achievement, where it, like, if a big record falls, you know, oh, this person finished the 100-meter dash in this, or like Tony Hawk does the 900, like, it never happens, then it happens, then all of a sudden everyone can do it, you know. It's like something about it has shown, oh, this is possible, so now the boundary has been pushed. And I just wonder if this is, I think it has the potential of being that kind of game for a certain artistic style.
I feel like it could go either way, though, because this is also the craftsmanship of someone that is just singular, right?
Like, yes.
I compared Sam Lake to Kojima, because because I was saying, like, nobody makes Kojima games like Kojima. Well, except for Sam Lake, because this game feels like a Kojima game, right?
Yeah.
I have a hard time imagining a creative director coming to this game and go, like, what do you take from this? Like, sure, the corkboard, but like, the corkboard doesn't make Alan Wake 2.
Yeah.
It's not everything. The horror elements. Like, it's this conglomeration that makes it so singular. And I think trying to unweave this strange tapestry to see how it was crafted in a way that works is a nigh impossible task.
Yeah.
So who knows? I mean, could be 50-50.
Yeah. I mean, it's so fun to see Remedy. It almost feels like it's hard for a studio like Remedy to survive in this day and age, just how the way that the economy and the industry in general is working. And it's so fun to see them stick around long enough that I feel like this confluence of events where the technology and their skills and interests and the audience and what people are now receptive for, with Control and Alan Wake 2, it feels like they've lasted long enough that they found their historical moment, where if, you know, they could have, you could see what they were doing with when you were playing Max Payne but this is the realization of that. And they were able to persist long enough to, I feel like, get to this historical moment where they're able to put something out and get the reception that they got. Whereas if they were a few years earlier, it might have been a really cool curio that only game nerds know about.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah. I also wonder whether or not the universe building is something that is a lesson that will be taken from this. Not just franchise building, because we've had that in video games for a long time. But the crossover between different games, different franchises of Control and Alan Wake, and maybe even Quantum Break, who knows, TBD. Yeah. Like, that idea, which we see in film, isn't carried out upon very often in video games, right? Like, imagine if everything Supergiant made had a through line, right? Like, Transistor and Hades had, like, some kind of strange overlap. Like, that would be a weird thing. But I do think that there's something really special about building out that larger world.
Yes.
While still giving you room to make each sort of little mini franchise stand on its own.
Yeah. In a way that isn't just numbered sequels of Final Fantasy 16. Right. You know, it's like, I get it. Yeah, agreed. Yeah. Amazing game. Something that I was only casually following, and then you just hear this buzz growing around it. And I wasn't even, if you told me at the beginning of the year that I was even going to play this game, I'd be like, okay, yeah, whatever, maybe I will. And then all of a sudden it's become one of my, like, must-play games for people.
Yeah, I could tell when we were, like, every time we talked about it, you were more excited and effusive about it. And it became clear that, like, okay, this is going to be on Scott's list.
Yeah.
and mine, I guess.
Yes.
All right.
You're going to go do your number one.
Okay, I'll do my number one. Okay, my number one game of 2023 is Baldur's Gate 3.
Just like the Game Awards. Keely's got to you.
Keely got to me again. Here's the thing, right? Like, I was thinking about the way that games tell stories and the way that, as a player, the story that you bring to the table and make your own is what's so exciting. I, you know, again, I have played a ton of D&D. Something happened over the past, I would say, like, 10 years, right? Like, 10 years ago, I wanted to play D&D, and I could not find a DM. And so I decided I'm just going to run my own game. And so I started running a couple of different games. I started getting into the space. I started learning about different D&D rule systems and ethoses and the sort of theory and philosophy behind playing different kinds of D&D and the way that we tell stories. And I got a lot of respect from thinking back to some of the DMs that ran my games years ago in college, right? Mm-hmm. Or high school even, that made the worlds feel reactive to our actions, but independent of our existence, right? Like, we existed in a world where our actions could shape the landscape, but if we did nothing, it didn't care about us, right?
Yeah.
And there's just something fascinating about that approach to telling stories, and it's why I go back to D&D all the time and run campaigns to this day, right? I love the idea of people feeling like they're in a world that is respectful of them, that reacts to them, that is true to the way that it could be if they were telling this grand fantasy. And the result of that is this emergent story that comes out of your experience that at times is hilarious and comedic and funny in the way that sometimes only D&D can be.
Yeah.
Because players bring that humor, right? I don't write it in, but some of the most hilarious shit has happened in D&D, right?
Yeah.
To the other side, where there are moments that are just truly moving or terrifying or, like, awe-inspiring. And it's across game systems, right? The Alien RPG I love has made some just truly amazing cinematic moments that came purely out of the improvisation of my players. And not in the, like, I'm an improv club and I'm trying to be funny. Just reacting to the reality of the world. Yeah, like, it's just, they're just reacting to the reality of the world, right? Like, they're not channeling a superhero or channeling creators. They themselves as players are reacting to the world, and the world is reacting to them. That is extremely difficult to capture in video games. And I think Baldur's Gate 3 does it better than any game that I've played from a narrative perspective. It's better than BioWare. It's better than all those other ones. Yeah. It is wild to me, especially from a multiplayer perspective, which I've done a little bit in Baldur's Gate 3, how respectful and adaptive Baldur's Gate 3 is to your player decisions, be it the class that you want to play, the approach you want to take to combat, the things that you want to say to friends and allies, the enemies you want to make along the way, the people you can kill or not kill, the way that you can just bypass huge challenges at will. We talk about this in games all the time. Like, oh, this RPG, you could have missed this, or you could have missed this, or you could have chosen to go around the other way. But Baldur's Gate 3 encapsulates the ethos of that better than anything I've experienced. And it is extremely respectful, not just of the spirit of Dungeons and Dragons, but the respectful of player agency and respecting the player in that way. And to that, I just had to give it my game of the year list because it felt like it understood what we as players of these types of games and stories want, right? And it is that respect and care in everything that they do. Like the quality of the score, which is just fucking banger after banger, is incredible. Like the quality of the writing, no matter what decision that you're making, the story arcs are touching and cool. Like there's just so, and there's so much of it. It is a phenomenal accomplishment that this game was made at all. And yes, it was in early access for years. And yes, they did a lot of behind the scenes work and a lot of like blood, sweat and tears went into it. It's wild to me how big of an accomplishment it was. And for what they were aiming to achieve, they just knocked it out of the park. And I think it's really cool to see Larian getting as much praise as they have. We talked about Baldur's Gate 3 potentially being the shining example of what games could be, and like, is it an outlier? And I think in many ways it is, and that's exactly why we should strive for it, right? Like we should measure games against Baldur's Gate 3 because it is the best of us in regards to the respect and the care that a team can put into a story-driven, player-driven experience.
It's an amazing story. I mean, just even on a meta level, it's an amazing story for Larian and for this has to be one of the highest profile early access games that has ever
outside of like Hades or something.
But even Hades was, just the scale of recognition of Baldur's Gate versus Hades. Like Hades was everybody's game of the year in the circles that we run in, not on the stage, I don't know. It just seems like they did something on a different scale, like Xbox was like trumpeting that, hey, now we have Baldur's Gate, everybody. Like that's an amazing reality to live in, that the Xbox brand is like, we got to get Baldur's Gate, It's just the, what they were able to do and the care and the time that they put into that, and every single thing and every single person you talk to has a different, story that comes out of the same sets of story of narratives. It's just, all of that stuff is just extremely impressive to me. Well, and the fact that it, for the most part, doesn't fly off the rails is just an amazing accomplishment.
Well, the timing is perfect too, right? Because D&D has never been as popular as it is today. But going into creating Baldur's Gate 3, picking up that IP years and years afterwards, like I don't necessarily think this was in the bag even 2 to 3 years ago, right? Like this isn't the type of game for everyone. You know, there's a lot of people that don't play D&D or for whom this type of expansive, long, deep investment RPG is too finicky, maybe even too challenging for them. And so I don't think it was a sure thing by any means. And I think it just happened to not just be so expertly executed, but it landed at a time when people were sort of ready for it. And I think to that end, like it is such a, like a unique splash this year.
Yeah. Agreed. Congrats, Baldur's Gate 3.
Congrats, Baldur's Gate 3. My game of the year.
All right. My number one, we'll cover off on the other one that everyone's talking about. My number one is The Legend of Zelda, Tears of the Kingdom.
Yes.
I don't even really know where to start in describing this game. I guess the way that I keep coming back to is that I think Breath of the Wild kind of reset my expectations as to not only what a Zelda game could be, but what an open world game should be in the modern era. And then doing the follow-up to that was okay, what are they going to do with this? And what they chose to do was not just broaden the world, which they did on the vertical axis with like the different layers or whatever of the world, but they brought in the guardrails of what you could do in the world in a way that kind of like Baldur's Gate from a narrative perspective, and this is just from like a physical tactile game perspective, it's amazing that this game doesn't fly apart at the seams. And you know, everything, you know, they gave you a set of tools that were purposefully meant to incent you into breaking sequences of the game in where traditionally in Zelda you'd go from floor one to floor two, from floor three, whatever, and this one's like, hey, you have all the tools, do whatever you want with it, here's the end goal, and you have the beginning and you have the end and then a big old circle and you can take whatever path you want and whatever tools you want and just go for it. It's all on the table and it works, you know, like it's kind of like a weird, you know, Gary's Mod thing, except Nintendo made it, you know?
Yeah. Tears of the Kingdom, when I first played it, was like, okay, this is going to be my game of the year.
Yeah.
And then I played Alan Wake 2 and like I gave it some more thought and I sat with it and I sort of, some things didn't sit with me as well. Also, there's an element of like, I think I have an unfair judgment of it in a way because I see it as an extension of Breath of the Wild, which was our game of the year the year that it came out, right? which is unfair. It's like, dude, how do you take a game that is like so fucking good and then it's like, hey, you want more of this awesome thing that we made? Yeah. And you're like, I just had the awesome thing though. Like it's definitely an unfair like judgment.
Spelunky and Spelunky 2 type of problem. You know, what do you do? You know.
But I do think the game sings. I also think that there are elements in Tears of the Kingdom that feel much more vibe oriented, if that makes sense. Like some of the stories and the environments that you're in. Maybe it's because it's juxtaposed to the dark underworld or the crazy like sky islands, but just feels a bit more like chill and vibey, such that I really enjoyed my time spent there, right? Like the quest line of rebuilding the little village that gets attacked by pirates, right? That was that's a vibe quest. And I love it. I think it's super cool.
Yeah.
And I think all of the stuff with Princess Zelda and the stories and the dragon, like that stuff works so well in the same way that Breath of the Wild works, right? Like the surprisingly deep, compelling narrative that is behind the events of these games continue to impress me, given that this is an open world game where you spend so much time experiencing the world asynchronously or non-chronologically, right? Like you can get pieces of Princess Zelda stories at different moments and it still works. No matter how you patch it together, it works and it's really effective. And that is not an easy thing to do. And yet Nintendo's pulled it off twice. So
I very much agreed. It's one of those games, and again, it's hard not to sound effusive or
now's the time. It's the game of the year cast, you know.
It is. It's just funny because I'm such a easy mark for a lot of the Nintendo games, but Tears of the Kingdom is one of those experiences that and again, I think it's actually quite similar in some ways to Baldur's Gate, where it's one of those games that feels like the games I imagined when I was a kid, like, oh, what if games were like this?
Yeah.
And I think both of those games actually are good examples of, there was probably a time decades ago where we could only dream of what if a game could let you do X? Like, what if a game could let you make any decision and totally bypass this crazy boss
and time
what if a game, what happens if you could create your own tank in a game and just go across the land instead of the horse, you know? It's like that, and I think both of those games are examples of it. We realized, you know, thanks to the skill of the developers and the progress of the technology, we've come to a place where games that we that were just theoretical can now be real. And I think that that was one of the things that I took away from Tears of the Kingdom, where it's like, oh, if you would have told me that this game was possible even 10 years ago, I'd be like, eh, that sounds... It's like a cold fusion. It's like, yeah, maybe in 10 years, you know, maybe in 10 years, you know, but like, this is it. And I think Baldur's Gate and Zelda are one, are those like, are kind of like those cold fusion moments for video games.
Yeah. That's a beautiful way of putting it. I also think that it kind of connects to the way that Tears of the Kingdom feels so playful in your ability to just build and craft things to meet your desires, right? The, it is, was such a, just like Breath of the Wild, but even more so in that you're going to actually build constructions. Yeah. It was a treat to watch people do it and come up with creative solutions to problems or just convoluted Rube Goldberg like devices to accomplish really dumb mundane things. Like, I saw someone build what looked to be like a tractor with walls that were like crunching, and they just kind of like scooped up enemies and just put them into this death machine. It was hilarious and it worked. I could never build something like that, but there's something really playful about it. Almost like at it's best in those experiences is more of a toy or a sandbox than it is a video game. And I think that is a testament to how fun and creative the tools they give you are. And like you said, despite how wild and wacky things can be, totally work. It does not break. So,
yeah, I think it definitely took over our house this year too, which is very funny. Like everyone in my household is constantly talking about this game, and it's just gonna be fun for both of us, I think, in the next few years, because at a certain point your kids are gonna age into it, and then our kids will collectively age into something a little bit more risque, like Baldur's Gate or whatever. Like, I think some of these games I'm it's exciting because of the sandbox nature, because of the everyone's story will be a little bit different. Like, you're going to be able to rediscover these games through the growth of your family in a few years, which is just going to be so fun. Like, I can't wait for your kids to play Breath of the Wild, because they're going to have a great time. And I can't wait for our kids to get older and we do a campaign of some sort of D&D-esque offshoot, you know?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Anyway, that's I just laid out the next 10 years of our family life. So congrats, everybody.
Our 2033 game of the year.
Exactly. Cool. Well, I think it's the top three of an amazing year. It was a fun problem to have trying to puzzle out which are the top games. So I was glad we were able to do it, and I'm super glad we're going to be able to talk about some of the leftovers next week.
Yes, there are going to be a lot, and also, man, there are so many games that I just want to shout out, being like, someone please play this. It came out a long time ago. We did Chia last week, but Chia's going to be on there. There's going to be more. So definitely check that out.
Yeah. Cool. All right. We'll leave it there for this week. experiencepoints@gmail.com is our email address.
And experiencepoints.net is our website. You can find us wherever you find podcasts. Do us a favor, leave us a review, and tell a friend. And Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, everyone. And as always, thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Ciao. Every time we disagree.